Okay, so just first off, I do not have any financial relationships to disclose. So what I'm going to talk to you about in the next 15 or 20 minutes is we're going to talk about the issue of racial and ethnic disparities in depressive symptoms among pregnant women. Depression during pregnancy is quite prevalent as it is in the general population, and I just want to emphasize that a lot of times in maternal health research, we emphasize how important maternal health is for their babies, and it's also very important for the moms themselves. And just want to make that point clear, and that's partially why I'm focused on this issue. And one of the things that that I'm really interested in is looking at what I think of as sort of a three-way interaction effect. So I'm really interested in what the effects are between racial and ethnic groups once we look at both their individual level economic situations as well as their neighborhood level economic situations. Do we still see those sorts of very large, typically observed racial and ethnic disparities in depression? And in case it's not abundantly clear, that picture on the left is a three-way interaction. So just a little bit in terms of the methodological motivations for this study. So there's been a lot of work, as you know, on neighborhood effects on health in lots of different health areas. There's lots of review articles out there. Lots of work has been done. But there still remains a lot of methodological challenges, and I'm not going to go through all of them, just to maybe point your attention to the ones that are shown here in red. There hasn't been a whole lot of interaction effects examined. So for example, if you are poor or not poor or very affluent, does your neighborhood environment affect you in a similar way? Not a lot of that work has been done, and some of the findings have been mixed, and of course it depends on the health outcome and the population, et cetera. As well, as we saw with the previous presentation, there's such tremendous stratification she was looking at the socioeconomic stratification, but we're even more stratified when we look at racial and ethnic differences in terms of our neighborhood environments. And so when you control for individual level STS, or you're looking at neighborhood environments and, you know, controlling for that, you're sort of creating these sort of false situations. I think it's referred to as non-positivity in epidemiology. And so there's lots of good reasons why we might want to stratify by individual socioeconomic status or by neighborhood environments and see what those influences are on health. I think it can tell us a lot more. So back in grad school in the 90s, I was very struck by this pretty elegant study that was done by Brandon Centerwall. And what he was looking at is rates of racial differences, black-white differences in domestic homicide among people that were living in Atlanta. And so what he was interested in was that if we looked at within a measure of social context, here he was looking at rates of crowded housing, residential crowded housing, where the victim was residing, would we still see a big racial and ethnic difference in this outcome? And so this was just the study has really sat with me for a really long time, and I've always wanted to kind of do something similar, and I've done a lot of similar work in this area. And so what you see here with these red arrows, there were really only three strata of crowded housing where you could even test that assumption. It's because of this tremendous stratification we are as a society. And so within just these three groups, you really had adequate sample size to even look at this question. Was there a racial and ethnic difference once you looked within the social context? And so what you see is with the very high rates of crowded housing, there weren't any white domestic homicides. And if you looked at the population was very low. And then in the opposite extreme, very low rates of crowded housing, you didn't have the sample to look at that outcome. And so his hypothesis refused to reject the null hypothesis. So if you look at that bottom row, the 5.8, so without taking crowded housing into account at all, there was almost a six-fold increase in the odds, or was this relative risk of domestic homicide comparing black to white victims. And then if you looked within just the three strata where you could really look at this issue of within strata, did you still see this difference? And in fact, you did not find a statistically significant difference. And he replicated the study about 10 years later in New Orleans. So just a little bit of rationale for the current study. So some of the maybe limitations or challenges with this type of approach is that you really need to have a quite a large sample size to be able to represent the full distribution if you're going to be looking at racial differences in any kind of outcome or ethnic differences. As well, this study didn't, these previous studies, they weren't able to look at important individual level covariates, which really, you know, need to be taken into account, things like age and gender and other issues, and most importantly, socioeconomic status at the individual level. So what we're trying to do is address some of these limitations in this study, and I say we because it's a collaborative group. And our hypothesis is that there are large observed racial and ethnic differences in depressive symptoms during pregnancy if you don't adjust for anything. And we believe or we hypothesize that those would be eliminated if we are comparing women of similar income levels who are also living in similar neighborhood environments. And so basically that's why I refer to it as this kind of three-way interaction between race, ethnicity, individual level income, and neighborhood level socioeconomic status. So fortunately, Claire did a lot of the work for me. We're using similar data. She referred to this latent class analysis of the neighborhood trajectories. That's our measure of neighborhood SES in this study. So I'm not going to go through the details of that again, but we basically found these three classes that were identified from that analysis. So we're just, in this study, referring to them as long-term low SES, long-term moderate SES, long-term high SES. And again, that was from the Neighborhood Change Database, as well as the American Community Survey from 2005 to 2009. And so here, instead of those three lines that Claire had showed, I think there was like a green, red, and blue line to show the three different classes. This just kind of shows you those results in another form. So basically, looking at all census tracts in California, the kind of long-term low SES, low poverty trajectory that was almost 10% of the sample. In 1970, the intercept was about 28% poverty. The slope represents that increase over time, so about almost 3% poverty increase with each of those time points. The long-term moderate SES tracts, about a quarter of the sample was in that group, and you can see the intercept was a little bit higher poverty, 14% poor with an increasing slope over time. And then lastly, the long-term high SES tracts, almost two-thirds of the sample fit into that category, which we would expect. Much lower poverty starting out in 1970 with a pretty flat slope, pretty flat line over time. So just another way to interpret the graph that Claire showed. So at the individual level, again, we're using the MIHA data set, the Maternal and Infant Health Assessment, which is basically California's version of PRAMS. And same years as Claire, except we added on one more. I think she had 2003 to 2009. We have an additional year of data in this analysis. So there's about 3,500 women sampled every year in MIHA. And we're restricting this analysis to women who are at least ages 22 and over. We were just allowing more time for women to complete their education or at least complete a college education. Only women who had an accurate birth certificate address matched to a census tract, and that's about 97% of MIHA matches accurately. So this gives us about 25,000 women actually births. And so the dependent variable here is women responded yes to the question of whether during their pregnancy there was 2 weeks or longer when she felt sad, empty, or depressed most of the day. And so the range for that, according to race ethnicity, went from a low of about 17% among white women to about double among immigrant Latinas. The other covariates were examining age parity, marital status, maternal education, and family income. So we linked that survey data to the census level data. We looked at the prevalences of this felt depressed during pregnancy outcome stratified by race ethnicity, income, and neighborhood SES, and then we performed a series of logistic regression models in SAS using survey logistic to account for the survey design. So here's the first set of results. And so here across the top, you see the different neighborhood SES categories. Again, it's from that latent class analysis, the long-term low, moderate, and high. And then along the first column there, it's split up by the five racial ethnic groups were able to examine in MIHA, and then further stratify by whether the woman's income her family income was below the federal poverty level or above. So quite a crude measure of individual level income, but if you split it any further, you come down to small sample sizes. So even with 25,000 women, you still get into sample size issues if you're going to split it even further, which would have been ideal to do, is to look at multiple different income groups instead of just poor and not poor. So the red numbers are just shown here. That's the largest range. So among women, white women who have living in long-term high SES neighborhoods who are not poor have the lowest rates of reporting depressive symptoms during pregnancy, so at almost 14%. And white women in the most disadvantaged situations in terms of economic status, poor, living in neighborhoods with the longest poverty rates over time, they reported a prevalence of just over 50%, so 51.4%. So those are the extreme values. So first, the first set of models was just combining everybody together, doing the kind of typical adjusting for socioeconomic status, looking at whether there was a neighborhood effect. And so the first column there is just the unadjusted odds ratio, just for comparison. And you see these strong racial and ethnic disparities. So African-American women compared to white women having over 2 times the odds of reporting this variable. When you adjust for income, neighborhood, socioeconomic status with the latent classes, age, parity, marital status, maternal education, then you see the odds greatly attenuated but still statistically significant. We also see significant income and effects, and then that neighborhood long-term poverty effect goes away in the adjusted models. This is a very typical pattern you see in neighborhood effects research. So then next, what we did was same model, except we further stratified. Instead of doing combining everybody together, we looked at kind of 6 different models. So stratifying by neighborhood SES on the one hand into 3 groups, and among poor women or not poor women, and then what do the racial ethnic disparities look like. So here are the results for that. And what you will notice is that the disparities seem to be remaining in among women who are more socioeconomically advantaged. So women who are not poor and those living in the moderate and higher SES neighborhoods. So for example, the 1.74 comparing African-American women to white women living in long-term moderate neighborhoods and those and not being poor themselves. So there was still over 70% higher odds. And then you can kind of interpret the rest of those variables. So interestingly enough, there's another paper that I'm involved with that's being done at UCSF. Some of my colleagues are here that I worked on that paper. We were finding similar findings. I'm not going to spill the beans on what those results were, but there's some similar patterns happening in terms of this kind of work where we're kind of doing a stratification type of approach rather than a controlling away for everything type of approach. So it's interesting. We don't know exactly what it all means, but there does seem to be a small body of literature building up, looking at finding similar patterns. So just to summarize, in terms of limitations, pretty similar limitations that have already been discussed with these types of studies. Is that one question on depressive symptoms, is that mean depression? That's a big measurement issue with self-reported types of survey data. We don't know about how long women have been living in the neighborhoods. It's cross-sectional, all those sorts of limitations. So you really do need to have a large, diverse sample size to try to do these types of analysis, and that can be, a big limitation given this huge stratification patterns we see in this country. And then the unstratified models, we found these very significant, strong racial ethnic disparities in the fully adjusted models. But then once we stratified, we found that those disparities were really apparent only among women who were more advantaged themselves in terms of their income and the neighborhood socioeconomic environment. So, we're not really sure what this all means. What we think is that women who are not poor, women of color who are not poor, are not reaping the same advantages to their own economic status and their economic neighborhood context to the same extent as white women. And so what's going on there? Is this a relative deprivation type of issue? Are there unmeasured discrimination effects going on? Are they feeling relatively isolated? So these are some hypotheses that we're thinking about. Certainly there would have to be new studies to kind of test that out. What does it all mean? And I'll just end there and just acknowledge my collaborators and funding administrative resources. And thank you very much. Yeah, that's the biggest measurement question that we have, and I'm not aware of other work that has validated that measure. There's probably other people here who have. I do know that the MIHA responses to that variable are very similar to other prevalence estimates of the same question. So I don't know of work that has validated that against depression, but I imagine it has been done. Here and then. Yeah, so this is a male telephone, male, and then non-respondents are followed up by telephone, so it's a self-administered, it's not a clinical type of, sample. But thank you for that. And then there was one hand here, and then you.
Hi, did you solve for the immigration status of these individuals?
Yeah, so the groups who were able to look at separately by immigration status were the Latinas. So most of the Asian and Pacific Islander women in California give birth are also immigrants, but then when you split those out, then the U.S.-born sample becomes quite small. So we haven't looked at that group, and among the other groups, there's very, very small numbers of immigrants. Good question. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you if you had thought about looking at communities, because I know my observation is that the depression is prevalent among that community. So I was wondering if you had thought about looking at stratifying by communities and then neighborhoods within that, because those kind of, you miss those groups and looking at what their needs are.
We do, and that MIHA also classifies them under the category of white, so I don't think we can, unless they have a write-in response, I don't believe we're able to separate those out. Is that correct, Kristen? I
think.
From birth certificate data. Okay. Mm-hmm. Wait, go ahead. And they're sort of geographically kind of concentrated. Yes?
This is really a contribution to this literature. The people at WHO who were writing about conceptual frameworks and social determinants have been struggling trying to articulate mechanisms. And this seems to fit nicely under differential vulnerability. And we've been talking about differential exposures and implicit in the labs and perhaps differential content and practices. So if you were to, for the next step you would do, what other vulnerabilities, presumably depression is but one of the aspects of vulnerability, education and capabilities related to the same might be another. How do you see this fitting in with a more deeply complex framing of differential vulnerabilities as a mechanism related to depression?
Well, what's really nice about the MIHA data set, and I have a in collaboration with others, a follow-up data set. So after the children are ages 5 to 9, we have re-interviewed a significant proportion of the MEHA sample, and we're delving a lot more in depth. Well, MEHA is all super in-depth about early childhood, adverse early childhood experiences, a list of different types of stressors that women have gone through both before and during pregnancy. And then we're repeating a lot of those measures in that follow-up survey, but the focus is more on different types of health outcomes like obesity-related behaviors and smoking and secondhand exposure. And we're going to be collecting more of the residential history data a little bit more finely. MEHA also examines experiences of racism. So those are measures are going to be on there and also repeated. So I think there's a lot of different issues of differential vulnerabilities we can be looking at. I don't know if that helps answer the question.
Yeah.
Instead of looking at the multiple, yeah. So more of the intersectionality types of issues, kind of how do multiple stressors or risk factors then influence your later health outcomes. Thank you. And then, Claire, did you have your hand up too? Mustard sweater first.
Thank you.
Absolutely. That is the plan. So this was the first step. We've done, I think, a pretty careful latent class analysis of racial and ethnic concentrations in among the six counties that we're focusing on. So not just percentage African American or whatnot, but you know, how, if neighborhoods are mixed, is there a lot of foreign-born immigrant, you know, kind of taking into account some multiple dimensions, and that's sort of part of the overall study. So we definitely will, thinking about socioeconomic segregation as well as racial and ethnic segregation, those are the two main kind of environmental constructs we're interested in, as well as the role of the built environment. So absolutely, and thank you for that. And in terms of parity, it was first birth, the second to fourth birth versus five or more births was how that variable is measured. Oh, sorry.
Can you go back to the findings for last? That one. Yeah, so can you comment on the MEHA fact that although most of them aren't significant, the racial disparities are actually in the opposite direction in the for women who are both poor and living in the most poor neighborhoods, so that everyone's doing better than
white. Yeah, I think we kind of see that also just in the prevalences where the highest prevalence in those among poor women who are also living in the most, you know, the long-term low SES, they have the highest rates compared to each other group. So it's almost like poor women of color living in poor neighborhoods are sort of more resilient to their environment, even though we don't see these statistically significant effects. That's sort of the direction. So they're not enjoying the advantages of living in the better off places with higher income, and they're more resilient to these more adverse conditions is sort of my thoughts on that. It's a little bit, you know, moving around a little bit in those cells, but that seems to be the direction it's heading, and thank you for pointing that out. Of course, your study makes me think, is this the right way to measure neighborhood trajectories over time? But we won't, if we split it into more groups, we don't have the sample size. We're going to need like 50 years of MEHA to be able to do that. One more. That's a wonderful question. I'm wondering why I'm in Texas, too. No. Just kidding. Love it. Love Austin. It's all good. I've had a long-term working relationship with my colleagues at UCSF who are here in the audience, and then I ended up taking a position at UT, and so we're still working very closely together. How come? No. Yeah, they can't let go of me yet. Okay, I think it's maybe lunchtime. So, thank you all.